Blog.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto coming to you live from the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California. I'm here today with a special guest, my friend, April Wood. April, are you there?
Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you? We're having a little bit of technical difficulties. Again, the power of Skype and using Mac. So we're going to work our way through this and continue to go. It's kind of odd. We're out at April's house today, and I'm outside, and she is inside on a phone, and I'm here on the Mac. So, April, if you could, introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, what you're about, and we'll get into this show.
Hi, my name is April Wood. I run a kennel of Siberian Huskies with my husband, John. Our kennel name is Duras Siberians. We've been doing this for 20-some years now, and we're located in Aubrey, California, currently. We have 30 Siberians, well, 29 Siberians and one Shiba Inu who thinks she's a Siberian.
So when you say you run Siberians, what does that mean for people that may just be coming into this show and not necessarily involved in dog sports? What does a run Siberians mean?
That means that's a term for hooking them up in harness in front of a sled or a cart of some wheeled rig of some sort and going down the trail, and we enter dog sled races, and there are some cart races that during the dry season.
So you said you've been doing this for 20 years. How did you get involved with the Siberian Husky?
Well, when I was 15, I was on a camping trip with my family, and we were in Ashton, Idaho, because we lived in Blackfoot, Idaho, and we were going up into the park up there, and we stopped in Ashton at the Husky gas station of all places, and there was two cute little Siberian Husky puppies, and I bought one and my dad bought the other, and the rest just kind of tumbleweeded into now.
You know, that's very similar to how I got started. I was in college in Portland, Oregon, and I was looking. At that time, they didn't really have internet. I believe I was looking in some type of magazine, and the next thing you know, I was on a plane to Georgia and bought my first two Siberian Huskies, and like you said, it just kind of tumbleweeds into history. Two turned into four, four turned into eight, eight turned into 32 at one point, and I tell you what, 32 Siberian Huskies in the yard is it's a chore, isn't it?
Look at it as a chore because I really enjoy spending all the time with all the dogs, and a lot of people wonder how I do it, but to me it just comes natural, and whether there's two out there or 40, it really doesn't matter. Just something I love doing is spending time with the dogs.
And you also breed Siberians, do you not?
Yeah, well, my joke is I let them breed each other, but on a controlled basis.
And you have a litter on the ground right now, and I know that we've been fortunate enough to be able to purchase one of those little guys, and we've talked about it on the last couple of shows. What can you tell us about your lines of dogs, including where they come from, what lines, et cetera? Because we do have quite a bit of mushers that listen to this show as well.
Well, a lot of our lines, we've got some based out of some friends of ours called, their kennel name is Desmar Siberians, and our three foundation girls come out of their kennel, and they go back through some Aniak, and there's some Cossack back there, and a mixture of some show some of the show kennels, and then some older style mushing kennels. And then we've got some lines out of Karen Ramstead's kennel, North Wapiti, with a mixture of some Alica Cyber that we got a couple of dogs there from Kim and Kelly Berg back east. And then we've got a couple a dog from Karen Yergain with some Timnotki that goes back into the older Miomar lines. So we've got a pretty good different variety of lineage in our kennel, and we just kind of mix and match that in to blend into something that can go into the show ring or out on the trail and exceed at both venues.
As Karen Romstead says, kind of her motto is pretty sled dogs. Is that what you claim as well?
Well, I like to add one word in there. I like to say pretty fast sled dogs because I don't think my dogs are very slow.
Right. And we're going to tell that story here in just a little bit about our training run this morning up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, and I'm looking forward to get into that. But yesterday when you and I were talking here at your kennel, you had mentioned about doing some stuff with some guys over in Germany. And that's news to me, being a Siberian owner and breeder and racer for a long time. I had no idea that people were really involved in dog sledding in Germany. Do you care to talk about that a bit?
Yeah, that's fine. 7 years ago, we had a litter on the ground out of our older mate, dog, Aladar. He's going to be 9 this fall. And he's out of North Wapiti's Guy Smiley and our Desmar's draw a bag of tricks, Trixie. And we had the mom is a dog we have named Feather, and she's out of our older girl, Honey, and a friend of ours, his champion boy, who was Pacas Tumnaka Tempus. It's really a weird name, but anyway, so we had this litter on the ground, and we had a gal inquire from Germany one day wanting to buy one of the puppies, and she was looking at one of our other puppies that we had listed as available. But the more we talked about it, of why she was looking for, what she was looking for and what she was wanting to do, we decided that it was in the best interest for us and for her to send something really good over there because she was wanting to improve the lines over there. So we sent her our pick male out of that litter over to her, and she's been very happy with him. And that just kind of led to her purchasing another female from us out of a later litter. And then she's got a friend who purchased another male from us out of another. So it's just kind of turned into a trading thing, and they're just trying to improve the lines over there. Same purpose. They want to be able to show their dogs and run them in harness and do well at both venues because that's what they're after too.
So what can you tell me about sled dog racing in Germany, and how are Siberians holding up over there? Do you know?
I don't know a whole lot about the sled dog racing. I know they're really big into, just about as big as the States. They have several races a year over there, and they have some kart races too over there. So, yeah, I'm not real sure about all the events they have, but I know they have quite a few, as well as the dog shows.
Okay. All right, so let's get into what you do for a living with your dogs. And I know that just like every other musher out there, you have a full-time job, but this is truly your passion. So let's talk about some of the things that you do with your dogs. I know that you're the race secretary for the Sierra Nevada Dog Drivers Club. What else do you do, April?
Well, I also maintain the website for the club, and I do dog grooming. I used to be a full-time dog groomer, but I still do a little bit here and there on the side.
And tell us about the Sierra Nevada Dog Drivers. That club has quite a bit of history. They started in the late 60s, I believe. Is that true?
The early 60s, I believe it was.
The early 60s. And they've pretty much evolved with dog sledding here in the lower 48 states. So what is going on with that club, and where does it stand today?
Well, it's still got a strong member base. We have a few races still here in California. Maybe not quite as many as back in the day, but we still have at least, are involved with 3 races minimum. And we've talked about adding some dry land events someday.
Are these sprint races, mid-distance races, what?
Mostly sprint, and we have a mid-distance class. Generally, it runs about 14 miles for the mid-distance.
And, you know, when people think about dog sledding in California, typically they don't mix very well. But here in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, you can truly get in some quite a good amount of dog sledding, and they have some pretty good conditions up here in the mountains, don't they?
Oh, very, very good conditions. There's good trails for training in the fall and in the winter when the snow is on the ground. There's a good variety of groomed snowmobile trails to go out on, and there's tons of wilderness, so you could just go miles and miles. It's such a big state and a vast area. There's wilderness and national forest that offers miles of opportunity to get go off your dogs.
So with the Sierra Nevada dog drivers, what is the makeup of the club? Are people running purebred teams? Are they running Alaskans? Are they running a mixture? Are there any Malamute teams at all? I know that's kind of an oddity these days. What are people running here in this club?
Most of the members tend to run the Alaskans, but there are a good amount of members that also run the purebred Siberian Huskies. We've got a couple members that run Malamutes as well. One of our lifetime members, Charlene LaBelle, has a Malamutes, and she's been a member of the club forever, and she has Malamutes, and I believe there was a couple others, but they're not so prevalent.
Right. So how long have you been involved in the club, April?
About 5 years.
5 years, and you've been the race secretary for how long?
Four.
and that's a job in itself. You got to make sure all the entries are taken care of, and I'm sure you got to deal with everybody hemming and hawing about their entry fees and everything else. What does a race secretary do, and why do you do it?
Well, every year I update the entry forms, and then we present it to the club for any input on any changes we might want to make, check the entry fees, make sure it's feasible, adjust it if we need to. And then we get it out there to everybody that we, you know, for people can fill it out and enter. And then they mail their entries in to me, and I do up a spreadsheet to track everybody who's entered and who's paid. And we allow a new thing, because I don't like faxes, because I don't have a fax machine, but we allow email entries so people can are allowed to email their entry in so they can get into the draw, and then when they show up to the mushroom meeting Friday night, they bring their signed entry form and their check, so I have to kind of keep track of all that, and then I put all the bibs, all the packets together that has their bib and their trail map and any starting orders and all that fun stuff, and then we hand it out to the entrance as they show up, and then I collect the bibs at the end of the first day, because all our races are 2 days, and so at the end of the first day I'll help the timers by taking the times and then plugging them into the spreadsheet and then reordering them to come up with the new starting order for the second day, depending on what they decide, if it's the fastest team out first or the slowest team out first.
So with that, do you still have time to race yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was race secretary for two of the races this year, and then I helped with the Forest Hill race. I helped their race secretary with just because she wanted to be able to do it, so I just kind of supervised in that. But, yeah, I raced at them as well. As a matter of fact, at Chester, I even did race two teams.
So what classes do you race in? Is it 4-dog, 6-dog, 8-dog, what?
Well, in all the prior years, I've done the 6 sprint, which is about 6 miles with 6 dogs. But this year, I did the mid-distance with six dogs, and then my 15-year-old son, he did a 6-dog team in the 6-mile class. And then at a couple of the races, we had a couple of 4-dog teams entered.
And this truly is a family business, isn't it? I know your kids are involved and your husband is involved, and really everybody jumps in and takes care of business. Can you tell us a little bit about what goes on with your husband and your son who's involved in this? Do they run dogs? You said that your son did, but has your husband ever been on the back of the sled? tell us a little bit about John.
Yeah, John's been on the back of the sled a time or two, and he's been out with the teams on the carts and stuff, so he doesn't do it quite as much, but he's been known to get out there and take a team out every so often. And our two older girls have been involved too in running teams, and they've both attended a race or two themselves and been out on training runs. There was one time actually, the three kids, John, me, and a friend of ours and his brother came up. We'd had like five teams out on the trail one day. It was a lot of fun.
You guys have an awesome place to go train. I know we went up there this morning and had to come up pretty early before it got too hot here in California. What is that place called where you guys go?
That particular place was out at Jose Basin.
And that's all dry land training, isn't it? Is there any snow this low?
Well, this last winter, they got like about a foot of snow, one of the snowstorms, but we were up, I believe, at Weed racing at the Siskiyou race.
Okay.
So I missed it.
Right. So how often do you guys get up to train, and how far do you train typically? What type of equipment do you use? Do you use a cart, a rig, a quad? What do you use?
Well, we have a couple varieties of different carts that we use. I'd like to use get a quad to add to that variety for in the dryland training, just so I could start running some bigger teams, because, as you know, some of our little venture, eight dogs with that one cart is kind of tricky.
Right. And you typically take out one or two teams at a time?
Generally, if it's just my son and I, we'll sometimes take one bigger team out, so there's like two people to help work with the dogs. But we've also taken out two teams separately. It's easier on the snow because you can set the hook, and it's a little easier out on the snow with the sleds to run two separate teams. And when we went up to train with just me and him, and we took two teams, one of us would hold both leaders while the other hooked the rest of the teams up, and then we'd shoot off one, and then the other would go. So it was kind of tricky, but we managed.
With your son and his racing, I know that he has, in the past, he's run some races with you. How is his success on the trail?
He's done really well. He did a couple races in the junior class, and then in 2009, he ran the first four dog team up at Chester, but he ran a friend of ours' dogs, Barb Schaefer. She had a team, and the one that was going to race didn't show up, so he got the opportunity to run that. And then late that March, we went up down to Ponderosa, which is east of Porterville, out and stayed with some friends, and we went sledding, and he ran a team of his own of five dogs, and so I asked him, I was like, well, are you ready to do six? And he says, yeah, so because we have had this nice training pool because all our youngsters were turning two and three and ready to do a full season. So this last year he did four races in the six dog 6 mile class, and he did really well with them.
Very good. You're listening to Mushroom Huskies, brought to you by Twine Group Media and part of Denver Dog Works. I'm here in Auberry, California, with a good friend of mine, April Wood, and she is a Siberian owner, breeder, racer, and she also shows them occasionally, and we are talking about a little bit about her history, what she's been involved in, and right now we're talking about racing with her and her son and how it is a family involvement. So, April, last night when you and I were talking, I know that you and I have some plans together of racing in a couple of races this year, but what are you planning on doing this year?
Well, my goal is to try and up my team size, maybe do some 8 and 12 dog classes, and try and up my mileage as well and do some of the little bit longer, because I want to get into the longer distances, because I just love being out on the trail with the dogs and going the longer distances. So maybe do some 20 or 30 milers.
And you know, every musher's dilemma is how they incorporate their passion and their love of dog sledding with the daily life of also, you know, every one of us have to have a job. So how does that interfere? I know a lot of people ask me questions about that. when they want to get involved in any type of dog sports, the amount of time and money that it takes. And I tell people all the time, there are two types of mushers. Either the mushers that can afford to do it on their own and that's all they do, or everybody else that is struggling like nobody's business and you know, lives hand to fist and doing it on their off time. How do you guys manage up here with your family?
Well, amazingly, we do rather well considering, you know, trying to just, we managed to get all the bills paid and we still managed to find some money to put some gas in the truck and go up to train, because even living here, we have to live close enough where we can go work, which is still 40 miles, but it's worth it because we live up here in the foothills. But all the training runs are, you know, half hour to an hour drive just for the closer ones. But we just make do. It's our hobby. And as I tell people who don't, like at work, who don't really understand why we spend so much money on our dogs, I ask them, well, how much does it cost you to go play golf? Or how much did it cost you to go see the Lakers win their championship last weekend, you know?
Right. Go ahead.
I said, then it makes a little more sense to them, because everybody has their hobby and something they spend their extra money on, and the dogs is ours.
And this is by far not a poor man's hobby, isn't it?
No, it's not a poor man's hobby. And I like that word hobby, because people go, they ask me all the time, do you make a lot of money off the dogs? I tell them, no, I spend a lot of money on the dogs.
Right, and unless you have a sponsorship or unless you are winning races with decent sized purses, you're lucky to come home on a race weekend with a free bag of dog food, huh?
Yeah, if that.
Yeah, if that. It's all about the way of life running sled dogs, and I'm so happy to have the privilege to be involved in it, and so many people have such a mystique about this of the glamour and the romanticism of dog sledding, but it is a tremendous amount of work. It takes a tremendous amount of time and energy on everybody's part to be involved in something like this. So if you will, April, tell us about the day in the life of, what you do here at your kennel.
Well, on a typical work week, I get up at 5:00 in the morning and I go out and give everybody their dog food and check their water buckets, make sure they're full, and scoop the poop. And that generally takes about an hour to get everybody taken care of and settled down. And then I go in and clean up and drive the 40 miles to work. And then when we get home, in the summertime when it's hot, we wait a couple hours until it starts to cool down in the evening, and then we just do it all over, give everybody their food and water and clean the buckets and scoop the poop and put new bedding down if they need it and play with the puppies. And
it's very similar to a farming lifestyle, isn't it?
Very similar, yes.
And a lot of people understand that. A lot of people think they can have, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 dogs and on a piece of property and they can go to work every day and, you know, it's all this glamour, but I tell you what, I've shoveled many a tons of dog poop over the years, and it is hard work. And I know you said that you don't think of it as work, but it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do a kennel of even your size. And you had exactly what I used to have, about 30 Siberians. That is small compared to the identity guide have, you know, over 100, and of course they have handlers and assistants and whatnot. But 30 dogs—that's quite a bit of work, isn't it?
Yeah, it takes some dedication and some energy, and a lot of people don't know. Ask me how I do it, and it's just what I love and what I live for.
So let's talk a little bit about a racing season. What amount of time do you guys spend going to races? How far do you guys travel? Do you stay pretty much right here in California? Where do you go, et cetera?
Well, typically, I try to get up to the – I've been up to the Chemult, Oregon race, which was a 12-hour drive back in 2007. I haven't been able to make it back up there yet. So, but most of the time we've been here in California at the sometimes they occasionally have a race up here above us at Shaver Lake, and then we have the, and that's only like an hour drive, even closer for us now this year, but they didn't have it. But the races up at Chester and Weed is a 6 to 8 hour drive.
And with that 6 to 8 hour drive, for a lot of people that, again, who want to get involved in this, they say, oh, just throw them in the back of the truck and you know, cruise on up. There's a whole process that's involved with that. You have to stop every couple hours to drop your dogs and let them take a break and water them and all that sort of stuff. So that 12-hour drive can easily turn into a much longer ordeal, can't it?
Yes, yes, because, well, our dogs are used to traveling. Some dogs that aren't have to, mushers have, the drivers, they have to stop more often. But generally our dogs will go for about 3 to 4 hours, and then we'll find a good spot to pull over and let them out, pee, stretch their legs, get a drink of water, and then we'll load them back up and go again. So, and usually we kind of coordinate those kind of with the gas ups.
Right.
So, like, get gas, and then we find a parking lot or a dirt field or somewhere and let the dogs out and take a break, and then we go back on our way.
And, you know, going back to a little bit of that romanticism about the public, people love that when you – when you're dropping your dogs at, you know, at a hotel parking lot or at some rest stop, people just love to come up. And while you're trying to get your chores done, they want to hear all about it, don't they?
Yeah. Yes, they do. When we traveled, a friend and I went to Montana last year in December to race. We got that a lot. We'd stop somewhere to drop the dogs. And people go, what do you mean drop the dogs? And that means to take them out. We take them out of their dog box and we put them on the outrigger, little cable tie-outs that go alongside the truck so they can just stand right there and do their business. And people drive by and stop and want to talk. So sometimes those stops can take, instead of a half an hour to an hour, they can take, you know, longer. It depends on how many people stop and want to talk and take pictures and ask questions. And it's really good education for the public because it really gives the opportunity to talk to people that don't see that sort of thing.
Right. And again, they're used to seeing Snow Dogs and Iron Will and Eight Below, and it just looks like so much fun, and it is. It's a blast. But there's a lot of poop picking up, isn't there?
A lot of poop, and a lot of other stuff going on that you got to take care of, and toenails and pad hair and checking the dog over, making sure there's no issues going on with them, make sure their health stays good. A lot of puppy shots.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your breeding program and how you raise your dogs. That's probably the most important aspect of dog sledding is what you're doing every other day that you're not racing. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of your animal husbandry protocol and that sort of thing? What do you guys do that sets you apart from somebody else?
Oh, I don't know that we do anything different than most people. Our dogs are all in kennels. We try not to kennel any boys with girls. That way, if the girls have a silent season, that there's not going to be, you know, any accidental breedings. And you can only do so much to prevent those, but occasionally they happen. But most of the time, we just, you know, make sure we keep track of all the girls with heat cycles. I really thought hard about doing any breeding this year because I had a couple runs of bad luck with my last two litters, but that's a whole other story, and that's just another heartache that you got to deal with in doing this is sometimes bad luck happens, and you just got to deal with it and try to move on from there. But we, you know, I had to really plan the couple litters that I did have because I have one, and then we've got another one due on Saturday. But just trying to plan, because I was thinking about doing another one, but then I got thinking, oh, wait a minute, if I do one now, she's not going to be ready for the race season, which is our main focus now. And so we just try to, you know, control that and plan it and come up, you know, and I'm always thinking about who I want to breed to who and what kind of puppies they might have and if that will progress the breeding program forward or not.
And so that's an interesting point that you brought up. You're trying to forecast what kind of dogs that they're going to throw is the term in the dog world. What does that mean? Why is that so important? And how do you look at it from a musher's perspective? If you're breeding dog A to dog B, why is that important in regards for your team?
Well, because we want dogs that are going to be able to perform in harness and fulfill our expectations. And so we have to take each dog into consideration what that dog can give to us and how we can improve on that dog, and then find a mate that we feel will has those strong points that will improve, hopefully improve when we combine, that we can like improve. Maybe we want a little better croup slope on them, or maybe we need a little bit longer upper arm, and or maybe a little more layback on the shoulder. And we have to look at the faults and of each dog and the points to make sure that they don't have the same fault, because then you're going to get that fault. And so you have to kind of mix and match and also take in considered lineage. But the build and temperament and everything is all first foremost important, because you have to think about what their lines are going to produce and what that dog can give you and what can enhance that to make something better and closer to the standard, and either get something better than the parents or at least as good, if not better.
And, you know, that's a whole other topic about holding up to the standard of the Siberian and showing dogs and the whole politics involved behind that. And I did that for years, and I hated it. I hated going to dog shows because of that. And I have been told by so many judges over the years, that is not a Siberian. And I say, sir or ma'am, this is what a Siberian is supposed to look like, not the little roly-poly, furry little guys that you see on television. These are the working line Siberians, and this is what you should hold to your standard, and this is what you should hold to your example of the breed. Have you found that to be a problem these days?
Yes, and it all goes on who's educating that judge, where that judge got their education from, and, you know, did they go to several different types of kennels, or did they just go to a couple, you know, where... It's all education, education, education. The judges can only judge what the people bring them to the show.
Right.
And so if more judges saw more of the working line dogs, then they would be more educated as to what a working Siberian looks like and what their coat feels like. And a dog that comes from the deep in the Arctic is going to have a thicker, denser coat than, say, a dog that lives down in southern Texas.
And there is a big difference between your prototypical show dog and a working sled dog Siberian, isn't it?
Well, there's not a real – I mean, I wouldn't say there's a huge difference, but dogs – I've noticed about this breed, they're so adaptable that they can learn to adapt to their different climates that they live in as well. So if they live in a warmer, humid climate, they just adapt and they don't get as heavy a coat in. Yeah, if you take that same dog and, you know, out of some of the lines that and take it up into northern, you know, deep into Alaska in the middle of winter, and it learns to live there, it'll adapt and it'll automatically change its coat, because it's just something that's just amazing about this breed is they can adapt to whatever climate they're living in.
And that's true. And I'm talking a little bit more about the conformation, you know, the structure of the dog. You know, a show dog will be, you know, one particular style. And as we mentioned, kind of the barrel-chested, short-legged, you know, poofy-looking Siberian versus a working Siberian will tend to be a little bit more leggy, tend to be a little bit more lanky and thin. It looks much more like an athlete compared to, you know, a beauty pageant entry.
Well, that's true. That's true.
And of course, and we were talking about Karen Romstad's kennel, and she mentions that her motto is pretty sled dogs. That's what we're talking about. There is a difference. And I remember I used to say when I was running a lot of sled dogs that my dogs had three things. They had beauty, brains, and brawn. And if they could have all three, that's the perfect example, in my opinion, of a Siberian. How about yours?
Yes, mine too.
Yeah, and that's what everybody envisions if they're a dog sled owner, with Siberians, is they want to make sure that they are very true to the to the standard of the breed, but they can also do what they're supposed to do on the behind the sled. And I've worked with so many people over the years that's had a Siberian, and they could not pull in harness. They were not structurally sound enough to be able to do that because they've had so many years in their lines of breeding where pretty much they were useless as sled dogs. Have you found that in your yes. comings and going as well?
Yes, I have seen a few dogs that probably couldn't pull, you know, that have been hooked up and they didn't have the desire to pull. I mean, I'll admit I have a couple in my kennel that they will, but they just don't have the same desire as some of the my more current lines do.
Right.
And it really makes a difference in that, and it's really amazing. And I mean, in years and years of going to dog shows, the thing about a dog show is you're going in and you're getting that one judge's opinion on whether he thinks that dog is a good example or not. But whereas working several dogs in harness, you get to pit their performance against other dogs and the clock and nature and, you know, and you get to see if they can actually do what they're supposed to do. And it's not, there's no opinion at all based on that.
Right, and the AKC does have several classifications for that, the sled dog and the sled dog excellent and things like that. And you had just mentioned to me last night about another working title for hiking. Can you tell us a little bit about both of those programs, the sled dog program as well as the hiking program that you mentioned last night?
I'll touch a little bit on. I don't know all the particulars of the sled dog program. I do know that it's not through AKC; it's through the parent club that Siberian.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Yes.
Right, but their other program, you know, and the sled dog degree programs are based on the performance of the dogs in comparison to the other teams on those heats that you race, and you have to be within like one third of the time of the top three or something like that. All the particulars are laid out in their guidelines, which can be found on their website. But the working dog program is fairly new. It's about, let's see, they instilled it in 1999 when we got our three dogs. They were the first to actually earn the official degree, which was kind of cool. But it's the working pack dog is 40 miles of documented hikes broken up into different segments. There's like two of them have to be at least 10 miles, and then the others have to be at least 5 miles until it equals 40. And you have to, the backpack has to start out weighing about 20, it's at 25% of the dog's body weight. So if your dog weighs 50 pounds, the pack has to have a starting weight of 25% of that. So then at the end of your hike, your pack has to weigh 10% of that.
And with that, you can earn a title that you can use similar to other types of titles like Canine Good Citizen and that sort of thing. And again, that just enhances your kennel and what your dogs are able to do. And what I find interesting with this hiking program is it's another way to get out and do stuff with your dogs and make them a full-time activity with you and your family. You guys can go hiking, you can go camping with your dogs. It's not just all behind the sled. And I know we had a show a few months ago where we talked about off-season activities and how important those are, whether you're doing agility with your dogs or swimming with your dogs and other types of things to keep those muscles going, because a sled dog just can't sit, you know, 5 or 6 months of the year and then run full bore, you know, 12 miles an hour down the trail on the other time. Do you agree?
Oh, I totally agree, Robert, because they need some sort of conditioning to keep those muscles from atrophy in the summertime. And I like taking the dogs hiking because it's one-on-one with the dog. You have an opportunity to let the dog go out in front. It builds confidence for them. I use it to do some command training for G and Ha and lining out. And we go through water crossings. And it's really a good, great confidence builder, especially for the young dogs, to help build their confidence and feel confident that they don't have to have another dog in front of them. And it's great one-on-one time for bonding with the dogs too. So it's a lot of fun.
And we talked about that this morning on our drive back. And I know we've been teasing our listeners about our adventures on the trail. We're going to get to that in just a second. But we talked about how important that communication is with your leaders. And hiking and other one-on-one activities are so crucial to that sort of thing. And you and I were mentioning the kind of the new wave in urban mushing is with these little scooters. And what a better way to train a couple of leaders, even a puppy, with a you know, a seasoned leader to teach that little guy how to respond to commands. What do you think about you know, training leaders other ways than, you know, having them pull a sled down a trail?
Oh, I love using the scooter because I recently got a couple of our scooters ourselves so we could use, because it just, the dogs, they don't have anyone else to rely on. So they have to learn that they're the ones that got to pull and make it go and make the decisions. And I love using the scooters. And I mean, I just use it in everything. I even use it when I've got them in the tub, giving them a bath. If I'm going to turn around to wash the other side, I'll use the command G or HA to turn. And it just instills those commands, and it helps with the leaders. I just take every opportunity I can to use that to hopefully build strong leaders, because you're only as fast as your leaders when you have a team going.
That's exactly right. So I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit, and I always ask this to all of my mushers that we talk about, whether it be in an interview or just one-on-one conversations. What is your take on kennels versus tie-outs, and why?
Well, I like both aspects. And actually, the tie-outs would be easier for mushers because when you have kennels, we generally have two dogs per kennel on most of them. And so if one dog doesn't get to go, you either got to fight to get him in and out of the kennel and tell the other one to stay. And when you come back, you give the little discussions of, oh, how come you got to go and I didn't? So that's the downfall I see with the kennels. And you have the fence in between you, so it's really, you have to, like, go into each kennel to interact. Whereas on tie-outs, you can go out and walk through your dog yard and spend some individual one-on-one time with each dog, and you don't have to worry about gates or snaps or fences and all that. And it can be more personable with the dogs than I would. And I would love to go to a setup without on tie-outs because it just would be so much more interactive with the dogs, because you still have them close enough where they can play with each other, but then they have the option of interacting with more than one neighbor, because they can go and interact with this dog over here or go interact with their other neighbor. So I think the tie-outs are great, and there's nothing wrong with it because the dogs actually have a lot more room than when they're in a kennel, if you do the math.
Right, right. And I've been a kennel guy my entire Siberian life. I've always had my dogs in kennels. And that's one of the things that I'm struggling with when I'm thinking about setting up a kennel for the Iditarod run in a few years, on whether I should go with kennels and or tie-outs. And it's typically, a musher is typically one side or the other. They usually either swear by the kennel or they swear by the tie-out, and they have their allegiance to one or the other for their particular reasons. But I do think the tie-out method, there is a little bit more human interaction with the dogs than there is in the kennel because of the interaction that they have constantly, especially if they've lived together, of the dog interaction.
Plus, Robert, with the dogs that are in the kennels, I'll admit they can. I'm sure they can feel a little closed in at times, and that's why we try to have a big play yard to let them out to run around in and stuff. But the other thing where you have to look at with kennels is if you live in a location where you're going to get some deep snow. I've seen where the deep snow just collapses that chain link.
Right.
And you know, in other words, you have to have a roof, but then they're not exposed. Out used to the elements as much if they're all roofed in. So you really have to look at if you're living in somewhere that's going to have some snow falling on you and getting some deep snow, then that's where the tie-outs are advantaged because they have the systems where the tie-out just extends up as however deep the snow goes, and they just keep raising the houses up or down and adjust with the snow level. Whereas kennels, you don't have that option.
Right. So my next question is purely a Siberian question, And I pretty much know the answer to it already. But a lot of mushers do a lot of free-running training where the dogs are running free. I know a lot of Iditarod guys train their dogs, especially in the off-season, with off-line training or out-of-harness training, whatever you want to call it. How do you partake in that with a group of Siberians, if you do, and why?
Well, I haven't personally done it myself, but I know of a few breeder mushers that run Siberians exclusively that free run their pups, and they start taking them out when they're like just starting to be weaned after they've had their first shots, is when I think they start taking them out. And they'll go out, and it's really good, and they really are into it. I know Karen Ronstadt is into doing more free running with her pups, and then there's Tim and Kelly Berg of Killing Siberians. They go out, and I see pictures and videos of them out free running their pups, and I've often thought of trying it. But it's just, to me, I got to find the right location to do that. And I might try that with this litter, these puppies that I've got this fall, is taking them out and doing some free running and see how it works.
There you go. There you go. So, April, before we do, you're listening to Mushu Huskies, part of Twine Group Media, and brought to you by Denver Dog Works. And I am here today with a good friend of mine, April Wood, at her awesome property here in Auberry, California. And I'm sitting outside here, and you got just this little, I don't know if it's a filly or a colt, but this little guy's just running around with mama, only 2 weeks old, and what a sight that is. Can you tell us a little bit about your property, where you guys live, and in relation to that, why do you guys choose to live here in California versus Montana or Minnesota or Alaska or what?
Well, it was kind of a long, funny story, as you heard last night, about how we ended up in California. And it's just been kind of like keep the kids in their school and trying to give them some stability that keeps us here and getting them out of, you know, through their schooling and job situation. You know, it's not just, you can't just go find a job anywhere these days. And so we just kind of make the best with what we do. And we live up in the foothills. It's a lot cool. It's like generally 5 or 10 degrees cooler than down in the valley floor, which is really nice for in the summertime. And plus, it puts us closer to the national forest where we can go do our training runs and whatnot.
It's an awesome place, and I'm going to put you on the spot one more time before we end the show, and we have about 10 minutes left. So I want to cover two more topics, and I want to end on the topic of our training run today. But you had mentioned you wanted to talk about your goals for the immediate future and a little bit further out. What are those goals for your guys' kennel here in California?
Well, for as far as the sledding aspect and the mushing, my immediate goals is, like I was saying earlier, I'd like to increase and get into some like 20, 30, 40 milers, maybe even a 50 mile or two, and, you know, eventually get into like the 200 and 300, and maybe even someday do Iditarod myself. It'd be kind of fun to at least try it. And maybe even Yukon Quest or something. But even if I went just like Race the Sky or Bear Grease one day, that would be just awesome.
And what do you see that in terms of future? Is that 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, what?
You know, maybe, you know, 5 years being doing like Bear Grease or Race to Sky is my kind of hopes.
And, you know, quite a few mushers, unless they're brought up in this lifestyle, quite a few, if not most, of the mushers are older people. They've had their careers. They're in their late 30s, early 40s, even 50s before they really get into dog sledding, aren't they?
Yes, I've noticed that a lot. And the same with a lot of people in dog shows. And we've done this and raised our family, you know. And so it's like I look at it, by the time the family's completely raised and out all on their own, which we only have one child living at home now. But where most people start out, we've got 20-some years invested into this already with time and knowledge and skills and experience. And so I figure I can go nowhere but up from here.
That's true, and I think you're doing great things here with your place, and I wish you well. So let's talk a little bit about our run this morning. It had been a long time since I've been on a cart, and as I told you on the way up this morning, What really changed my mind and what really changed the life at our household was going to Alaska this year and really getting to know some of those guys and figuring out if I'm going to do it, I need to do it now, and I need to quit talking about it. But we were lucky to get out there this morning and just do a real short run. But we had an experience, didn't we? Can you tell us a little bit about the squirrel on the road or whatever caused us a little bit of problem?
Yeah, Robert, thanks.
No problem. This is the stuff that people want to hear. You know that.
I figured, I mean, we had a short break in the temperature, so it was nice and cool, and the dogs were feeling. I knew they were going to be frisky because they haven't been out since Easter weekend. And one of the leaders, me not thinking about it, had not been on this particular run before, and I knew there was this rock crossing where we crossed that big rock, so the trail pretty much disappears, as you know. And that was just amazing. He just stopped out of nowhere for some reason and was sniffing the air, and they thought they were going to go off to the left, and I hollered up at MG, and he kind of looked at me and gave me the middle paw finger, and they took me down. You bailed, and they took me down that rock cliff, and I thought I was a goner.
Well, you know, I jumped off to get them back on trail.
Yeah, because you were going to go up and try and lead them up on the trail, yeah.
Yeah, you had said jump off and line them back out, and as soon as I jumped off, they took off running, and you literally wrapped yourself around that tree with your cart, and your cart is not one of those cheap, flimsy-made ones. That's a handmade 200-pound cart that your husband built for you, isn't it?
Well, we bought the cart, and then my husband modified, added some wings to make the sides a little more room for a passenger to stand on. So it's just been, it was originally made by Mike Fisher, one of the old sand dune cart, trail dog carts. And I have no idea how old that cart is. We bought it from our good friends, Jane Smith and Laura Crocker, and a few years back. And then John just last year modified it because that way when Tyrell goes out on the trail with me with the cart, there was a little bit more room for him to stand.
Right. And go ahead.
I was like, yeah, it's probably about 200 pounds.
And, you know, no musher is worth his salt if he doesn't fall and roll at least one time on every single training run. And you had your spill this morning, too, didn't you?
Yeah, after we got turned around, as I told you, I'm usually the one that's on the cart, and usually my son's the one jumping on, and as the team runs by, and I'm not that as agile as he is, and I took a pretty good tumble, yes.
A musher has 1,000 stories to tell about his falls, and you took a good one, but uninjured. You got a little cut on your hand, but it was a good way to start off the season. Even though we're in June, I think, as you mentioned, you're wanting to talk about doing some night runs from here on out and go up and do a little bit more, quick runs, even in the mornings or in the evenings. So what a way to get started than an implant on a tree and a nice little roll on the trail. And that was no joke of a trail. That's quite a bit of a rocky, hilly trail, isn't it?
Yes, because it's an unmaintained road, and so it's just, you know, washouts and ruts and all kinds of bumps and tree branches and all kinds of fun stuff to worry about.
Yeah. So before we close here, April, I have to ask you a question. I know you and I have talked about this, you and I and your husband, and you know where I'm standing. I have two opportunities to take advantage of, one here in California and another in Alaska. So I'm going to put you on the spot one more time. If you were in my shoes, and you know what I have in terms of family, very similar to your own, what would you do, Alaska or California, in regards to the goals of what I'm trying to accomplish?
Well, if you're going to be totally selfish and it's all about the Iditarod, then Alaska is the place to go. But if you're going to take into consideration of your family and your business and being able to work and support your lifestyle and stuff, I'm sure it would probably be good in Alaska. I don't know how well your kids would, you know, it depends on what kind of kids they all are. But, you know, as far as the dog training and stuff, it's just really a tough call because the dog training could be huge here in California, and still you have plenty of race opportunities. But it's a long haul to drive to Alaska with your 22 dogs or however many you take up there when you get ready to run it.
Right,
so
right.
It's a tough decision. I have a tough call because, you know, we've talked about.
And as we've talked about this entire show, this is a lifestyle. It isn't something that you can put away. You know, like you do your golf clubs in the winter. This is something that you do 365. And that's the decision that my family and I are struggling with, whether we do California or Alaska. And I've teased it for the last couple of weeks that we're going to make our decision after my daughter and I go up to Alaska in 2 weeks. We're going to come back on the July 10th show of Must You Huskies and let everybody know what we're going to do with our team, whether it be nothing and stay in Colorado or come out to California or go to Alaska. And that's a huge decision that we all have to make as a family. So in closing, April, tell people how they get in contact with you. I know that you're a Facebook master and you have a lot of friends that follow you and talk back and forth about dog sledding and mushing. How do people find out about you and your dogs and your dog sledding career?
Well, I have also, besides finding me on Facebook, and the only way to find me on Facebook is basically if you're going to find my personal Facebook page, you have to kind of be a friend of a friend because I kind of got incognito otherwise. But we also have our website, which is at www.jaraw.com. And if you go to that website, there's a Facebook badge on there where you can become a fan of the kennel itself, or as they call it, like now. And you can follow, we post pictures of our races and puppy pictures and fun stuff up there. We've had a puppy cam this year with this new litter here, which has been kind of fun. And you can email us off the website. There's the email links all over the place. If you want to inquire about available dogs, there's a application you can fill out and submit your information and get put on a waiting list. And
what is that website?
It was www.jaraw.com.
And that's the place to find out, and there's links to every place else. And if you want, there will be a link on our page as well on Facebook, and we're at facebook.com/DenverDogWorks. And you can hear this show anytime on Apple iTunes or through blogtalkradio.com/DogWorks. April, anything else before we close?
No, I think that's good.
Well, I appreciate you having me and your hospitality up here at your home, and we look forward to working together in the future. We will make sure to update our websites as well about your guys' teams in the near future, and we're brand new on theexaminer.com, and we'll put some links up there to some of your stories and things as well. April, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you again real soon on Must You Huskies. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. It was nice talking to you, too.
Thank you. You're listening to Must You Huskies, brought to you by Denver Dog Works and part of Twine Group Media. You can hear us every Sunday morning on blogtalkradio.com/DogWorks. Next week, we're going to get right back into our dog sledding legends. We've covered Leonard Seppala and Scotty Allen. So we're going to cover the history of the mushers in yesterday. So if you have any questions or comments, send them to live@dogdoctorradio.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter. We're all over the place. On Google, just type in Robert Forto, Denver Dog Works, or Team Aneke. My name is Robert Forto. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.